Blog Talk Radio.
That we start the show, it's so funny, but I do intend to again get lyrics for the show.
Sorry to subject you to this, to my lyrics, because I swear they just keep getting worse.
You know what? I had you pot it down. I don't know if you were singing or not. I didn't catch it if you did.
Oh, that's fine.
You know what?
It's better that way.
Sometimes what happens is you will get when we start the show and we go into the intro music, you get taken off and I have to actually physically pot you back up. I don't know why it does it. It must be it's got to be a Blog Talk Radio thing, because I don't do anything.
Yeah, maybe I should just take the hint.
Yeah, no, we can't have that, Meg. We gotta have we gotta have you singing. You know, we'll figure it out. So anyway, from the People's Republic of Minnesota, welcome to In the Closet Objectivist. I'm Corey Baum, along with Dr. Megan Ribbons and Stuart. I don't think will be joining us today. He's having some issues with his equipment or phone or something's going on. So we may not have
bummer.
Stuart. Yeah. I assume you got the message from him, or did you not?
I did, which is weird. I've kind of been elbows deep in microbes most of the day, so maybe that's how I missed it.
Yeah. Well, he just texted, texted, I guess, is an appropriate word, a couple hours ago, saying he may not be able to be in for the show, and I'm like, that's cool, buddy. Take her easy, and if you can get on, come on in. So that's kind of where we're at as far as who's on and who's off today. So, yeah, so how's it going, Maggie? You doing all right?
Yeah, doing really well. I know before the show we were talking about, microbes are good and Gracie is good and her school is good. And I'm having some, in front of Gracie, I call it adult grape juice, which is also good.
Yes. Yeah, and now what flavor is it? I mean, it's grape. Is it like a white grape juice or what do we got here?
Yes, it's a white juice. Let's see. It is a Sauvignon Blanc.
Oh, okay, Sauvignon. That's a good one. I like the there's a couple of different brands that I like. I don't drink a lot of wine, but when I do, there's a white Merlot. Have you ever had that?
I have not. I don't think I've seen that. Although, yeah, to be honest, every time I buy alcohol for myself, I always forget what I like. So every time I go into like a wine shop or a liquor store, it's like I've reset. You know what I mean? It's like Lenny from Memento. It's like a brand new experience every time.
Yeah, tell me about that. I hear you. We had this wine kick several years ago. In fact, a matter of fact, I got into this wine kick when I watched that movie Sideways. Have you ever seen that movie?
I have not.
Came out about 2006 or something like that, I think, or maybe like 2005 or 4. Yeah, it's a movie that's about wine, and it's about wine and these two guys. It's about these two guys that are on a road trip, basically, in the California wine country. One of them's getting married, and it's like a bachelor party for just the one guy. And Paul Giamatti, isn't it? I don't know if you know who that is. Michael, there's a guy from Wings that's in there. And then Sandra Oh from Grey's Anatomy, she's in it. Virginia Madsen's in it. Anyway, it got nominated for an Academy Award, but it didn't. I don't think it won. Anyway, it's a good movie. I recommend it. It's kind of it's not like you would think it would be. They're pretty I don't want to say belligerent, but it's a drunk fest, and it's not just this hoity-toity. We're drinking wine and sitting in the, you know, we're actually getting fucked up, and everything is, you know, they try to be like, we're just gonna.
I guess it is a bachelor road trip.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot like that. So, yeah, anyway, it's a good movie. I recommend it. It's been a long time since I saw it. So, but yeah, it's called Sideways. And yeah, that gets us off track quite a bit. All right, well, let me start
the weeds
here.
A little bit.
Yeah, whatever. We're just kind of winging it today anyway. I didn't prepare a whole lot. So let's go with the sideways the housekeeping.
Housekeeping?
No, thank you. Sleeping.
Housekeeping?
Can you come back in an hour?
Housekeeping, you want towels?
No towels. Need sleepy.
Housekeeping, you want mint for pillow?
Please go away. Let me sleep for the love of God!
And you can find us on Stitcher, iTunes, and the TuneIn Radio app, along with please follow us on Blog Talk Radio. I don't think we've gotten a new follower on Blog Talk for a little while, so we could use some of that. Also, you can join us on Facebook at In the Closet Objectivist group we have on Facebook. Please feel free to enter in that. We also do have a little Patreon group that you can donate to the show if you'd like. That would be great. Patreon.com/CoreyBaum. And thank you to everybody who has donated to that so far. I always want to remind you, though, that if you donate to that, it is a recurring charge. So be aware that if you put a dollar or whatever, however much you put in there, it's going to hit your card every month. So make sure if you just want to do it one time. There's a way to do one time, but you can't do it there. You could just join us on Facebook, and if you're interested in doing a one-time donation, you can do it there. So thank you anyway, and that's all I got for the housekeeping. I could lay out, you know, I haven't given the phone number here in a while, but, you know, I can give it, you know, if you're on Blog Talk Radio, you can find it, but I'll give it out here as well, which is 516-387-1224. So if you want to call in, I don't know. We don't get a lot of calls. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, but there it is. So, how's it going, Meg? I'm going to, you know what? Forget that. I got to do our news headline, which is, which is, it kind of, again, one that I'm just winging a little bit here. I just, me being I'm following along with the, oh my goodness, I'm having a complete.
The Atlas Shrugged project?
The Atlas Shrugged project.
I was going to ask you about it.
That's fine. You can do that. But because this is such a boss title for a new chapter that I just love it. So I think, so here's what I want to say. Every novel will now begin with some variation of the, this is John Galt speaking line, because that's so badass. You know what I mean? Like when he says like that, the chapter we read was, you know, this is John Galt speaking. And the way that the way that he says it is so awesome. It's just, it's such a badass line. It just, I don't know. I love that. I just love that. I think everything.
It's so funny that you said that because, you know, in deference to, you know, Ben Baer and Greg Salmiri doing their weekly Atlas project, and this time it's about the major speech of the novel, you know, the major philosophical reveal. I was listening to, a while back, Ankar Gatte, who is my favorite living philosopher, and that's a really tall order. Anyway, he did a 5-lecture course on the speech, and he had a number of questions that honestly had never occurred to me, and you know, I had trouble answering. You know, it's not like I haven't read and heard the speech a number of times, but for example, the first question he asked at the outset of the course was, why does he give this speech? And I thought that, like, that question had literally never occurred to me, because I was like, look, if I could make a speech like that, I would do it anywhere, anytime. If someone annoyed me or said something I thought was dumb, I would just start going, this is John Galt speaking.
It's so badass.
Mr.
Though,
Thompson,
right? I mean, it's like,
time is up. I have taken it over. You were here, you know.
I just, reading that though, it's just, I'm like, God, that's just a perfect, I'm like, ooh, that's good. I mean, that's just, it's so good to start that way.
And I think it's another part of the reason why I'd sort of missed a lot of the subtler points is because I was too busy like fist pumping.
Yeah.
It's like,
I do that a lot.
Yeah. Right on.
Yeah, I mean, I do that a lot when I read the novel, and especially the third time around. Oh, you know, and I know that I still am not catching a lot, but, you know, I can't wait to do it a fourth time and a fifth, you know, a fifth and a sixth, you know, and just keep going because I know I'll catch even more. But this third time is like, wow, am I catching stuff that I, you know, kind of missed before, you know, like, I don't know. I just, like, I didn't realize about how, you know, Philip really is I don't want to give away too. Well, who cares? Like how Philip is still trying to set. Yeah. Well, Hank Riordan's brother is really trying to set him up all throughout the movie or the novel. It's just he's always trying to set him up. And at first, when I first read the novel, I just thought this guy is just a schmuck and he's just trying to he wants to get a job, whatever. But I didn't realize he's, you know, and it's not easy to, you know, it's not hard to miss because it's right there. But, you know, if you're reading it for the first time, there's so much, second time, so much, even third time, way so much. So, I mean, you can still miss a lot of stuff, but, you know, I didn't realize how much he was really trying to set him up and trip him up in his, you know, like his mom is, you know, oh, poor, what are you going to turn your back on your family when he's walking out the door? And it's like, well, you know, when you first read it, it's like, oh, she kind of maybe feels bad for her, but she's actually just being an evil bitch, man. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. Yes. You know, well, and I had missed how, you know, in the very first Hank Riordan scene, Philip asked for money for Friends of Global Progress, right?
Yep.
And, I had totally missed that money, friends that he'd given through Philip to Friends of Global Progress, was directly used to fund, Friends of Global Progress draft the Equalization of Opportunity Bill? Came directly around to bite him in the ass.
Yeah. That it was basically, you know, just, again, we talked about the sanction of the victim and stuff, you know, a lot. And you know, that's part, I mean, you really start to see, especially for me, for, you know, at this point where it's such, you know, the sanction of the victim that just pops out every time that I read, you know, he's allowing this to happen through his, you know, through his own actions in a sense. Not, he's not, he's not seeing it until, you know, towards the end of the novel, whatever, that, you know, what's going on with really, you know, that these people are they shouldn't be pitied. You should be, you're just enabling them. You're just completely enabling these people. And he doesn't see it at first. And, you know, so, but yeah, I mean, I see something every time then, and it's great. I mean, you know, and then, you know, the whole, what was I going to say? We were talking yesterday, you know, Greg was talking and I was listening, but, about how, you know, like, how do I go about this here? I didn't really draft my notes too well. Did you listen to it at all?
Definitely more than I did.
Well, yeah, but yeah. So, you know, basically like how, I don't want to get too deep here. I'm trying to, where was I going with this? I kind of lost my train of thought too.
You know, we've kind of gotten into the weeds with the fake news headline, which I love, by the way, but mine is actually very similar. So if you don't mind getting off track
for
a moment.
Yeah,
my fake news headline, the headline I wish were true and may in fact be true, but, you know, so the fake news headline is due to popular demand, Ayn Rand Institute scholars are now doing courses on all of Ayn Rand's fiction. So week by week, chapter analyses of Anthem and Fountainhead and Night of January 16th and Think Twice and Ideal and We the Living. I've really enjoyed, I mean, Alice is my favorite book, bar none. And I was just thinking as you were talking about how much you enjoy reading it for a third time and you can't wait to read it a fourth time. Like, it's the same for me. You know, I will listen to other books, fiction and nonfiction, but especially the fiction, there's so many that I just can't finish due to boredom. I've become so picky in my old age. I just can't stick with characters that don't have a definite characterization. You know what I mean? They're, you know, Dagny is the embodiment of a railroad, right? She tries to find the straight line path and just goes full steam ahead. I mean, she's just unstoppable. I mean, the sequence of her building the John Galt line is so beautiful, right? Everyone tries to throw obstacles in her path for, like, really no good reason. They won't fund her. They, you know what I mean? They try to stop her from, like, having anyone actually run the train, you know what I mean? And she just keeps, you know what I mean? There are people, contractors working with who are like, you know, we don't want to work with this man. And he's like, well, I've given you all of the training that you need. What more do you want? They're like, well, I don't know. She's like, I can't help you with that. Make the switches.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's just, and she gets it done. She's so capable and brilliant and dedicated. I mean, there's just not enough good things to say about Dagny. I love Dagny. And after spending all of this time struggling and fighting with her, you know, it's and rooting for her, it's so hard to pull yourself out of that world and immerse yourself in a world where the characters aren't the embodiment of really anything. You know, they're pretty much interchangeable, and there's no reason why they'd be doing this thing versus that thing. You know, maybe they'll do the right thing and maybe you won't. And there's, you know what I mean? They don't give you really anything to go on, and they don't really give you any reason to care, which is just too bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember now what I was going to say, what I was trying to say earlier. And that is like when Reardon starts to find out all this stuff about himself and like what's really going on right towards the end. And this really struck me as like, I don't know what to make of this. Okay. So the looters, you know, he's meeting with the looters towards the end, you know, before he drops out and joins the Gulch. Or gets out of there, and he's finally seeing everything come into place. Like, what's going on? You know, why, you know, why are these people this way? And he starts to starts to see that it's not necessarily that, because they've, you know, what one of the looters, it is one of the worst ones. I forgot his name. It's right on the tip of my tongue, but he's like, he's saying, look. You guys can you can figure this out. Hank's saying, look, I can't keep doing this. I can't keep supplying and with what little I am allowed to do. I can't keep supplying you. And one of the looters says, well,
I think it's Jim Taggart. Yeah, he's like, you'll figure it out somehow.
Yeah, he goes, you'll figure it out somehow. You guys never, he's like, but, you know, how, you know, could it, you know, what about this time? And then one of them, you know, it's like, who is the real bad guy in that? Ah, son of a bitch. The name's on my tip of my tongue too. He's like, you guys have always, you've always come through before, basically. Like you've always, you know.
Yeah, it's either like, Dr. Floyd Ferris, or
that's it.
Yeah,
that's it. I think it's him. I think it is him. And he's like, "What do you? Why are you worried?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not happened yet. I mean, we haven't lost the world yet.
Yeah, it's so funny because Dowdy had that exact conversation with Jim Taggart before, and she's like, "Because I saved you, bastard. What are you intending to do when I'm gone?
Right. And so, but here's the thing, though, right? So he says. We've always come through before, basically. I'm just paraphrasing, you know, Ferris says, it's not happened before. And he makes it because we've saved you. Yes, exactly. Now that's where you make the where I started to make the connection between the education, you know, education, right. They've never told them. They've never stood up for themselves and said, "Hey, look, this is why the world is how it is." And without what the producer should have done from the get-go is said, "Look, here's why we do what we do, and here's why it's important." And you guys, they never really got into the why shit. Why they needed to know what they truly did. You know what I mean? Like, here's, you look at a guy like Reardon and Dagny and all these other guys, they took them for granted, right? Then they just said, they'll always be there, and then we can ride them, and they say, you know, they use their guilt, I guess, as a weapon, but a lot of them didn't realize the guilt until later on. But they never were like treated like children, and they never educated, and they kind of let them get away with that thinking for far too long. So it's like a spoiled kid, right? So your kids become spoiled. You don't really tell them. It's kind of like, you know, the millennials now. A lot of people ride on millennials. They say these fucking millennials. Well, who taught the millennials? Who taught them? Someone had to taught to teach them. So it's kind of our fault. That we never like said, look, here's why, you know, we produce work, and here's why it's important, and here's why you should respect it, and why you should aim to be like us, and not just, you know, leech and mooch and all this off of us. Does that make sense? Am I making sense there?
I've actually been thinking about that a lot because, you know, as I'm listening to Ankar Gate talk about the speech, he mentioned, you know, what it's like, you know, John Galt never directly addresses the looters, like the true villains, right? Because they don't want to live, you know? There's nothing you can say to someone that outwardly destructive and that self-destructive. You know what I mean? There's no pulling them back from that kind of evil. Mm-hmm. You know, who he's actually addressing with a few notable exceptions are the people who are kind of trying to ride the fence, right? The people kind of, you know, who are productive and don't really agree with the, you know, prevailing morality of the culture, but at least give lip service to it and support it in some way. And there's a lot of really deep reasons, which, and I'm just going to pilfer this straight from Ankara Gatte, because honestly, I think without him making explicit, I'm not sure I would have ever made these connections. So all kudos to him. You know, so he was talking about how James Taggart's mentality is, and the analogy Ankar used was, imagine you're being driven somewhere in a limo, and you put down the divider, and you discover that the driver's seat is empty, that there's nobody in the front seat. I mean, that would be terrifying, right?
Right.
So there's three things you could do, really. One of them is to jump in the front seat and take control. And that's what it is to be in focus, right? When Ayn Rand talks about how the primary choice is to be in focus or not, that's what she's talking about, is to engage, put yourself in the driver's seat and think.
Mm-hmm.
The second alternative is to pretend, you know, just sit there passively and pretend that there is someone in the driver's seat. And that, I mean, this isn't a perfect analogy, but that is most analogous to drift, right? You just kind of sit back there and don't engage.
Yes.
And the third and by far the most evil alternative is to evade, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't just mean that you run away from the obligation you have to yourself to protect your life, because this is very dangerous. But, I mean, in the case of James Taggart, his whole motivation is to show that his way of life, his evasion, is superior to those who are in focus and produce. And the only way to do that is to destroy, you know, what's being produced. And to destroy,
yeah.
Ultimately to destroy the producers themselves.
Right.
So it would be like, you know, you're going along down the highway with no driver, while everyone else is driving and engaged and actually, you know, propelling themselves. And instead of, you know, taking control of the wheel, you manage to drive everyone else off the road.
Yes.
Right, to show that your way is superior to theirs because you destroyed them. I'm not doing nearly as good a job as Dr. Gatte. So,
well, I mean, who can?
They're amazing.
Yeah. I mean, we're not on their levels, but yeah. Go ahead.
I mean, I would say what you were saying about millennials, like, not being taught to properly appreciate the people who have made our lives so amazing in the 21st century, it's true, but it's worse than that. I mean, I was just thinking about how, you know, when I was going through school, I was taught these disparate quote-unquote facts. They were just things that you had to memorize that didn't connect to anything else. You know what I mean? They were just floating things that you had to memorize that didn't connect to anything. And I really get why, like, if that is what you're taught to regard as knowledge, why integration would be meaningless to you, and why ideas themselves, ideas that connect different concrete, different facts, wouldn't mean anything to you. You know what I mean? Like, people will say stuff like, well, communism works in theory, but not in practice. That's sort of a tangential example, but, I mean, your first thought when someone says that should be, well, maybe the theory is wrong. Maybe we need
right.
to kind of re-examine. But, you know, if what ideas amount to are just disparate facts that have no connection to each other, why would you bother? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Why would you bother to examine whether or not one or all of the facts that, you know, things that you regard as true are actually true? You know, it explains a lot why, you know, a lot of people read Atlas Shrugged and carry on, you know, thinking that climate change is anthropogenic, or that, you know, they'll continue to carry on as they did before without really examining.
A lot of it is
their cherished belief.
Well, a lot of it is, you know, it's just a book, Meg. You know, that, I mean, the way that
well,
people.
Exactly, right? It's just,
they don't,
it's
they don't,
just another
yeah.
thing that doesn't connect to anything else.
Right. It's not, and I, you know, the more, you know, I here's a little thing, like Ma Chalmers, right? Ma Chalmers, she's an old lady. She was mother of Kip Chalmers, who gets into this horrible accident in the movie because, or in the, God, I keep saying movie, and the novel, because, you know, he's stubborn about, you know, he getting, there's a whole big thing about Kip Chalmers, and he's like a congressman, right, or something like that, and he wants to get somewhere, and he causes this big accident, and Ma Chalmers, you know, he dies in the accident, and Ma Chalmers, later on in the book, she's talking about how she wants part of her what does she make? She makes some sort of desserts or whatever, and oh, it's for the public health program. She's like, she wants to get this.
The soybean thing.
Yeah, she wants to get this. That's her priority in life, is to get people on soybeans, and in the schools and stuff. And I'm thinking that's Michelle Obama. You know what I mean? All of a sudden, I'm like, that's you know, I'm like, I started making connections in that way too. You know, like I'm thinking this lady who all of a sudden she's not that Michelle Obama lost a son or daughter, but she's trying to, you know, take over, or, you know, insert her ideas of how people should eat, you know, because of the public needs, supposedly, or in Michelle Obama's case, because of the kids and whatever. And, you know, it's just, there's just connections like that. This is a little one that just kind of popped into my head while, you know, we were talking and stuff. So, I mean, yeah, so, that, you know, there's just a lot of, as you're reading, there's just a lot of connections that you make, and you're like, oh, my God, you know, I got to take a note of this and store it for future reference wherever I can store it, you know.
Yeah, that's actually a really good example. And I know I did a podcast on nutrition a while ago, but I didn't realize how poor the recording quality was, and I really should just redo it, you know, in my...
No, it's just do a new one.
For time. Yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But it's a really good example, right? You know, Michelle Obama noticed that her children were suffering from obesity, so she made some dietary changes, and it really worked for them, and that's great. But she didn't then go on to say, hey, my kids had, you know, were in this condition, here's what I did, you know, see if this applies to your family. No, she went on a campaign to make sure that all children in all public schools did exactly what she did. Well, you can imagine that human nutrition is very highly contextual, and it's not something we fully understand. So, you know, she might say something like, you know, replace the white bread with wheat bread, you know, and offer it to every child. And you might say, well, someone with celiac disease has no business eating, a wheat bun. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you could, and there's, I mean, to be frank, I mean, most people, certainly most adults, could probably do without starches almost altogether, unless, you know, for example, if you're trying to become a really muscled, right, you might be in a, you'd have to go through these cycles of bulking and cutting, right? If you're in a bulking stage, you definitely want to have something with a high glycemic index, right before your workout, and then a certain amount of carbs and protein during and after your workout to really maximize, muscle growth and, increase mitochondria, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There's so many different contexts. There's so much about nutrition to know and hear. But so you might say, okay, talking about ideas and how a lot of people, I think, regard ideas as such, with such dismissal, you might say, Michelle Obama will say everyone should have wheat buns. And you say, well, there's this disease called celiac disease in which people are can't digest, certain molecules within wheat. And the way most people hold ideas, those two things are totally separate. You know what I mean? And there's no way to connect them and say, maybe wheat buns really aren't for everyone. Those are just two separate things that have no connection. But they have a life and death connection.
Yes.
Ideas do matter. And it's very troubling that a lot of people don't recognize that.
Right. And it's ideas matter, and they are more emotion driven. They're, if it feels good, it has to be good. It has to be. And that's where we get into this whole emotion versus reason versus all this. And people don't understand, if you're trying to, I know this has been said, how many more times can it be, but a million, but where you, just because it feels good, it doesn't mean it's right. Just because you can't, feelings don't matter. But it's not even a political issue necessarily. I mean, they both are very much, are emotional based, but it's, because you feel strongly about something doesn't mean it's right, or because it worked for you one time, it's going to work for everybody. People, I don't know why. I think people just want to have the answers. A lot of them, and they just, if it feels good, it has to be good. So that's it. You have to do a little more digging than just that. I think that's one of the, another, I was talking, sometimes they bring up, that's part of the reason I really love objectivism is because feelings are just, they're okay. I mean, the feelings are fine and, the emotions are fine, but it's not a primary. You gotta stop, because feelings are not reality. They're not always reality. They have to line up, I mean, in certain ways, but because you feel something doesn't mean that it's right or it's good. You got to get over that. And it doesn't matter if, what the issue is. You have to be able to sort through the emotion of it to really know if it's something that should be acted on, or if it's something that's appropriate or whatever. This really worries me, Meg, is that we're starting, and I think this has been not just starting, but been happening for a long time, is feelings and emotions are such integral parts of people's lives. It takes over. And I think it doesn't matter where you are politically or whatever, but I see it all the time. And we gotta temper that stuff. You know what I mean? it worries me that people are just emoting.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, I've learned painfully that emotions, because I tend to rationalize emotions. I've just always been really terrible with this. You know, if I didn't think I should feel something, then I would just set it aside. And I've had to, like I said, I've had to learn very painfully that emotions are really valuable data. You know what I mean? They're, mm-hmm. you know, as a scientist, the data are the data. You know, whether I want them to be, whatever I want them to be, they are what they are.
Right, right.
Which can be really frustrating in case anyone's wondering. But they are what they are. So, you know, I may be feeling an emotion that's uncomfortable or surprising. And that doesn't tell me why I feel it. You know what I mean? It takes a lot of hard, you know, sometimes painful in the sense that, like, you know, maybe I don't necessarily want to dig into the darker parts of my subconscious, but the only way I'm going to understand what these emotions are telling me is if I dig into them. And whatever the result is, it will be very revealing and useful. But by themselves, emotions don't tell me anything other than a total summation of everything that's going on. Now, there's a lot going on. So, you know, where a negative or a positive emotion is coming from is not always obvious, but it is important. But, you know, and so the example I use with people is like, imagine every time you go home, you feel awful. What do you do? And they're like, well, what do you mean? What do I do? That's nothing to go on. I'm like, yeah, you're right. Maybe, you know, you come home and the place is a mess and, you know, you need a cleaning service or something. Or maybe you come home and your significant other yells at you and you need to move on with the relationship or from the relationship. Or, you know, maybe you live in a crack house. I mean, who knows, right? Like,
right.
The emotion itself isn't telling you what's wrong. It's just telling you that something is wrong. It doesn't tell you, you know, what's going on or what to do to fix it. It doesn't tell you any of that. It just tells you to pay attention, which is important. I mean, I really, really don't want to understate that value, but it is of limited value, and cognition is not one of the values an emotion offers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, I'm totally making a show.
No, you're not. No. I had a, you know,
because you rescued me.
No, that's okay. No, because I was actually. I just want to get, because I just see it all the time. I mean, I just see it all the time where if it feels good, you know, for some reason that's okay. And no matter what the consequences are, or I haven't really thought of, you know, I'm just saying, this isn't me saying, but like, I haven't really thought about this, but it feels great. You know, it's like, you know, Yaron always brings up the taking drugs or doing cocaine, and that would feel really great. But, you know, it'd be bad in the long run, and that's true. So, I mean, I think that because you can't argue with somebody that just feels. It feels like this, and that – unless you're like wanting to be ruthlessly honest with yourself. But if it feels, you know, I just want people to get out of the, it's fine to feel something that just gives you an idea of what's, you know, doesn't give you necessarily a way to fix it or to deal with it, you know, but emotions are just, they've become just so bizarre and so out of control lately. And I don't know how long this has been going on, but it's been going on way too long where we need to get back to thinking about, okay, this is going on. How do we deal with it? And how do we, you know, how do we, in a productive way where, you know, we're not, you know, hurting ourselves or whatever. I mean, you know, I don't know. I just, yeah, I'm kind of rambling now about this. It's just, I've been thinking a lot about it. You know, I've been thinking about, you know, how do we get to a place where, because a lot of times people will be like, well, you're just, why are you so against emotions? And it's not that I'm against emotions or anything like that. I just say they're not tools of cognition. You have to think and you have to reason. And that's not always the same. You know, if you're just emoting all the time, and you're not really getting to the nuts of how to figure things out. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned this because I've been thinking a lot about this too. And you know, I learned recently that millennials have suffered from the highest incidence of anxiety and depression. Now, without being any kind of expert on millennials or anxiety or depression, it's like, okay, that's not super surprising, right? If you're taught to just emulate the group, and I do have some experience with this, that, you know, I mean, if it never occurs to you to connect what you learn to anything else that you know, right? What a terrible place to be in. Right. If there's no objective measure by which you can say I am good or I am capable of living, if there's no, you know, all you have to go on is the approbation of your peers or, you know, even like similarity to them. You know, no one can be a duplicate of anyone else. So if that is your standard by which you judge yourself good, you're going to fail. You know, you're not going to be good by that standard. Everyone is unique. If you can't, if it never occurs to you because you were never taught to connect ideas together and that reality is integrated, you know, each new situation is a terrifying one because you have nothing to go on. It's so tragic. And so, you know, these incidences of anxiety and depression, I mean, you know, maybe there's a biological component. I mean, certainly there is with these mental health issues. How much of it is the horrible education to which they've been subjected and how much of it is a real biological phenomenon, I cannot say. I have no idea. Right. But with regard to the horrible education, you know, what's going to fix that is not cuddles with puppies and kittens. Not that I mean, who doesn't love cuddles with puppies and kittens? And it right. does, you know, at least temporarily alleviate anxiety and depression. But ultimately, that's not going to fix the cause of the problem. And I guess that's another point that yeah. we're both kind of coming at, is that there is such a thing as causality. Right. I mean, it's another, if you don't regard ideas as connectable, causality is not really a thing in your mind, right? This thing happens and the other thing happens and they're not connected when indeed, you know, you push the ball and it rolls away from you. Those things definitely are connected. And I realize it's sort of a silly, simple example, but...
Well, no, but I always try to give examples like that, though, Mexico. That's fine. Yeah, no.
Yeah, and, I mean, you know, crappy public education, and then what do you know? You know, people don't think that there might be a causal relationship between crappy education and anxiety yeah. and depression. I mean, it probably is.
Yeah, you know, when you are... You know, like, we'll get back to the millennials. You're a young kid. I don't know how old they are now or what the age range is, but I don't know. I'm going to guess like 20s, whatever. So, you know, if you're constantly told, you know, kiss your boo-boos and, you know, whatever, it's just the next stage of, obviously, you know, what are they supposed to know, you know, if they're taught that, you know, that how can you, so when people blame millennials, I'm like, who taught them, you know, who is the, you know, so, yeah, so anyway, that's kind of my rant on millennials, but yeah, I mean, it's totally, you know, you have to be able to see the connection there and not just say, they didn't just drop out of the world, you know, out of the fucking sky, you know what I mean? Something happened. And a lot of people, and that's just, it seems to me, and I hate to generalize, but it seems to me that that's kind of the case, is nobody really wants to make the connection. They just want to say, oh, that just happened. This stupid millennial is, no, I mean, he came from somewhere, right? Where, you know, this thing that happened to you came from somewhere. It just didn't just happen to you. And like now, you know, this bastard, but it's figure it out. You know what I mean? Let's figure it out. Take a step back and go through what it is that happened, rather than just say, oh, this thing happened and I hope it doesn't happen again without, you know, trying to make sure that it doesn't happen again, kind of a thing.
Well, this is it, right? If you have no regard for ideas, there's no point in figuring things out, right? You just decide that it's because, you know, this generation is not as good as yours, and that's it, right? There's no helping them. I mean, if you have no regard for ideas, there's, you know, it probably doesn't even occur to one to figure out why, you know, or even hypothesize why they might be more prone to depression and anxiety and why they're, I mean, this is tragic, right? These people are our friends and our coworkers and our, you know, possibly children and grandchildren. And this is what their lives are like, where they're anxious and depressed and, you know, they haven't been taught to see causal connections and you know, to really value ideas that, you know, yeah. It's hard to even put myself in that mindset of like, you know, I'm in a profession that's all about ideas and discovering what's true and discarding what's not. And believe me, I do a lot of the latter. And the idea that there are people out there for whom that's completely foreign, I don't even really know how to relate to that idea that, yeah. You know, that, I mean, there are people who don't cherish ideas, but there are, and what a paltry existence that much must be.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry. I mean,
I really wasn't going anywhere more than that. It's just, you know, I don't understand people who just say, oh, those stupid millennials, and that's it, right? I mean, what a tragic existence. What have we done to these? You've read the scene with the wet nurse and Hank, the last scene.
I cry every time. The last time I read it, I was in bed reading it. I couldn't stop crying. Yeah, I know. And it's like this kid just wanted, you know, this is the way he kind of went through it. He never really had a chance because he didn't really have an education. He didn't really have, you know, and he figured it out, you know, but it was pretty, you know, late and got shot, you know,
I mean, and the imagery is so beautiful, right? I mean, what does Ayn Rand say? People would shudder in horror if they saw a mother bird taking her babies and plucking their wings off. right?
Yeah, yet that's...
Wings are a bird's means of survival. And to see a mother treat, you know, just strip her children of their only means of survival is horrifying.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we've been doing to our human children, right? I can't think of a word horrifying enough to convey the idea that, you know, a human being's means of survival isn't wings, obviously. It's our reasoning mind, you know?
Right.
We're actually, you know, not that dexterous or fast or strong
right.
or fearsome.
Right.
We're just smart and productive. That's all we've got, you know?
Yep.
So to have someone take, you know, their child and teach them that reason is impotent and ideas don't connect to each other and there's no causality and, you know, if you don't plant your seeds in the spring, well, maybe you'll still get a harvest in the fall. I mean,
yeah,
all of that is infinitely worse than the mother bird plucking out the wings of her children, and yet people have done it
and
done it thinking that they were doing right by their kids.
Yes.
And let me
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I'm like trying to find words to describe just how awful I regard that, how tragic I regard that, and I don't have words.
I don't know that I do either, but how do you resolve something like that when you get older? And I'm not saying like a parent, right, or whatever it is that way to you, right? Maybe they're not doing it. They're not doing it out of some sort of malevolence. They just think this is a way to do it. It's like, it's religion, right? So they say, don't worry, God will provide. So when you grow up to a certain degree or a certain age and you start to question things and you find out, hey, man, a lot of this or most of it or all of it is crap that you've told me, and you've gone by, you know, basically your whole life thinking that that's the right way to go and that's the right thing to do, and you find out, wait a minute, no, that's not. How do you reconcile a relationship with that person, or do you not? I wonder, you know what I mean?
I'm sure it's really, really highly contextual. I would say, and I think this is a very personal thing. For example, I've noticed that Yaron Brook really gets a charge from people challenging him. I don't really enjoy adversarial or combative conversations. I have a lot more success and a lot more enjoyment if I can identify an aspect of objectivism that, you know, with whomever I'm conversing, if they're anti-Trump, I will immediately point them to Ankar Gatte's article, The Anti-Intellectualism of Trump, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it will convert them to objectivism or whatever. I'm not looking
right.
to proselytize. But, it will give them a fresh perspective and maybe intrigue them. You know what I mean? I'm not looking to pick a fight. I'm not looking to show someone that they're wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I think if I just can't find a source of disagreement, I'll either not bother, which is usually the case, or I'll say, you know, the thing I love about atheism is that there's nothing ad hoc, right? I can just regard the universe and reality as this beautiful, integrated thing that never defaults on its own laws, which means I can learn what those laws are and leverage them to the benefit of my life and the the life of people I care about. You know, you can use gravity to good effect. You can learn how to, you know, create enough, you know, specific propulsion to escape Earth's gravity and go to low Earth orbit or to Mars. You know what I mean? Like, if you know what the rules are, you can know how to leverage them.
Yes.
If gravity suddenly reversed, or if, you know, the sea parted because gravity wasn't a thing for a few minutes, that would suck.
Yeah.
Fortunately, that's not the case.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Exactly. I mean, it was so enlightening to me to just hear Leonard Peikoff talk for the first time and just say things are what they are and do what they do. And I started to think, wait a minute, you know, this guy is speaking some stuff here. And I started to, you know, that was part of, you know, my journey, so to speak, of just realizing that, hey, what I have in front of me is what I have in front of me. I don't have to know or wonder whether I'm, you know, talking or whether I'm working on this computer, or this laptop. I know I am because I'm right here. I can do it. I can see it, and I never thought of that. You know what I mean? I didn't think of it that way. It's kind of seemed obvious, but it wasn't. You know?
I mean, a lot of people mourn the fact that there's no such thing as miracles. I find it, that's something to be rejoiced. I am genuinely grateful that there's no miracles when it comes to gravity. I don't want to fly off the face of a planet. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't want to go burn, you know, go up into the stratosphere without a plan and a rocket ship.
Without a jetpack. I was going to say a jetpack.
I don't want the things on my coffee table to fly off and hit me in the face either. But
right.
That's going to happen because there's no miracle.
Right. And that's what, you know, you wonder about, well, you watch like a movie like Poltergeist and you know, and you see that, you know, a table fly off, something would fly off the table. And you're like, what if that really happened? Like, you know, where you were just, you know, going about your day and a table just flipped, you know, a coffee cup just came and winged at you in the middle of the fucking day and just hit you upside the head. And there was no reason for it. And you had to just look out every other, you know, you had to just look out every once in a while and be like, shit, is something going to hit me? You know, I don't know. You know, anything could happen at any time. I mean, imagine that. That's crazy. I mean, to live like that, you know?
Yeah, there's so many reasons why. This is a real digression here, but I have no suspension of disbelief when it comes to movies, especially horror movies. For one thing, I used to live in LA for 10 years, right? I would drive through Brentwood. I would see the a-hole screenwriters at Brentwood cafes giving themselves a high five, you know, like the self high five when they wrote something stupid that they thought was brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would tell you that I watched Sharknado.
That was one of your, that was one of your recommendations. I didn't take you up on that, by the way. I haven't taken you.
Stop me if I told you this before. At one point, this is not really a spoiler. I mean, one of the actors is like, you know, a tornado is just a mix of hot and cold air. So if we throw a bomb into the tornado, it will neutralize it.
Yeah.
And you just know that the screenwriter was sitting in a cafe in Brentwood, and he's like, self high five.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they did they have the ponytail back then too? Or I mean, who knows?
I don't know.
That was a thing earlier. That was an 80s, maybe 90s thing. No. So yeah. But anyway, yeah. It's crazy and weird. And I just it's so interesting. You know, just talking to you and just me thinking about what I thought about just a minute ago, about just what if there was just no like rhyme or reason, and I could just you know, I could be sitting having a cup of coffee and all of a sudden my table would fly off or I would, you know, get hit in the head with something. I mean, that's basically what you're talking about when you just say there's no reality. Anything can happen. Anything can be what it is and what it isn't. I mean, if you think about it, it can drive you crazy, which is why I think people that.
Yeah. I mean, if you were serious about a total lack of causality, you would just be huddled in a corner for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be in
you'd
the,
be utterly
in
paralyzed.
Yeah.
And to the extent, it's so interesting because I'm sure you know a good deal about the history of philosophy, and it's happened over and over again, right? Someone will make this huge, they'll ask a question and address it in philosophy, but it's not the whole answer, right? Because philosophy is an ongoing science. There's still a lot more to know and understand. And it's very, very abstract. So, of course, some skeptic comes along and says, well, what about this thing? That's not that, you know, it doesn't offer any guidance. It just kind of deflates any progress made in the science of philosophy. And every time a skeptic comes along that's really influential, the whole civilization just crumbles. You know, skeptics are the worst.
To the extent, too, that someone takes them seriously, you can just brush them off. If you have half a brain, you can. But
it's utterly paralyzing. If you were a true skeptic and said, you know, I don't believe in gravity, I don't believe in the laws of nature, you would have to take seriously the possibility that your coffee cup is going to fly off the coffee table and into your face. And so you would have to be, you know, huddled in a fetal position in the corner for the rest of your life. Mentally, that's what skeptics do. That's their thing. To make us all kind of huddled in a fetal position, you know, at least philosophically. I guess it wasn't going anymore. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that historically that cycle has happened again and again.
Yeah.
It's kind of too bad that anytime a skeptic opens their mouth now, we don't just like, you know, shut them up in a closet or something.
Yeah, right. The nap would be thrown out. I'd have to, the non-aggression principle would have to not apply in that case. I would have to be highly aggressive. otherwise, I would.
Send them to a cafe in Brentwood so they could write a screenplay.
Exactly.
There we go.
Exactly.
Problem solved.
Exactly. it just having to live in Brentwood probably would be enough to drive anybody loopy. But what was I going to say now? Shoot, I had something. No, that's kind of what I've been thinking about more so lately is just, wait a second. I mean, it's so crazy and it can be so irritating and just perplexing. That's the word, perplex. You're just like, what is going on here? And, you know, to the extent that you take them seriously is, you know, is bad for you. And I like, here's what I wanted to say. I think a lot of these guys, skeptics that are more the academics, you know, they don't really believe that shit. It's like Floyd Ferris. He just preached it. He wrote a book about it. And what was it? How Do You Know You Know? Was that in his book? Something like that. And basically, all he wants is to control. He doesn't believe his shit. He doesn't believe anything he says, but as long as he's got enough people believe in it, then he can control them. And that's where a lot of, you know, these people come from. That's where they're trying to hit their mark is right there. So.
Yeah. To be honest, I found Floyd Ferris probably the hardest character to understand because it seems like he sees through his own BS.
Yes,
and yet he espouses it wholeheartedly. So I may be dramatizing my own point here. you know, I'm just kind of, I keep thinking to myself, like, what is he getting out of this? Like, writing a book is a serious effort. Why is he doing this? Why would he write, you know, What Makes You Think You Think? You know what I mean?
That's what it
and
is. Yeah.
I think I'm probably falling into the same trap that Dagny and Hank are, that I, you know, that I'm assuming that he's trying to profit in some way.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Instead of
yes.
simply destroy.
Yeah, profit and control people. You know, here's the thing is I wonder why would you want to destroy? Because you're going to end up destroying your own life, and you want to live, don't you? I mean, because you want all this control to have money, fame, and fortune or respect, I guess, or whatever you think you're going to get. Well, you can't get that if you're dead. So, I mean, obviously you want to be able to take the talons off of the host organism. You know what I mean? So that you could still, you know, suckle at the host's teat, you know, so you don't kill the host and you're able to enjoy the benefits still. Otherwise, if you go too far, you're going to kill off the host and you're going to, you know, that's going to be bad. So is that a bad example? Or,
No. That's the theme of like a scene from The Office that, there's a scene where Dwight says the best vampire is the one who doesn't kill the host, but like, you know, just kind of
yeah.
keep the host alive as long as possible.
Yeah. And we're talking about like
there, but again, we're assuming that his aim is to want to live rather than simply, you know, drive everyone else off the road, to mix metaphors. Which, you know, it's actually really encouraging that we're having this conversation, because I don't know if I'm – tell me if I'm alone on this. But for a long time, you know, I think ever since Hank's sanction of the victim speech, I was like, okay, why haven't they both, like, retired to the valley yet? You know what I mean? Like, why did they exist and stay in the world? And you know, the fact that we're talking about Floyd Ferris wanting to profit and wanting to keep the host alive so that the host lives, he lives, it means that Hank and Dagny are not the only ones who really struggle with this idea that some people really don't want to live. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they struggled for over 1,000 pages, and here we are, 1,000 pages later, and we're still struggling with that idea. You know, some people just are that destructive.
Yeah, they just they want to preach that life is meaningless and none of this matters, and then they have to have the power, and they actually want to live. They just don't want to work for it. They don't really want to work for it. They want to find other people to do it. And they just want to manipulate and ride off of other people's coattails. And that's, you know, as long as other people, lesser people, maybe they think that they're, you know, this great intellectual, that's okay. They can, you know, as long as they're kind of like in straddling the, they want to make sure that the people who are real, like Dagny and Hank and, you know, all these people, they want to make sure that they snow them under a little bit, you know, that they stay naive kind of to the fact of what they're really doing. Cause they're like, what is this guy doing? What is, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, so they're straddling that line between let these guys really find out what's going on, you know, cause otherwise, you know, the gig is up, so to speak. So, you know, as long as these other people that we can manipulate, the students or the people who are dumber, or I don't know if that's the right word, but the people who aren't as intellectual and don't care as much, or they want to work and they want to be honest, but they're not smart enough as other people are. They're just straddling that line, you know, of the producers and then the the people who don't produce or produce very little or whatever. I don't know if that makes sense, but
I'm not sure I'm completely following you, but it did bring up something else that Ankur Gatte was talking about with regard to John Galt's speech. I mean, you can the way he broke it up was it's really three parts, right? It's talking about the morality of life,
yep,
the morality
death.
Of death, and then the final part is you need to choose, right? John Galt has taken away all the producers that kind of supported those who were straddling the fence and, you know what I mean, didn't really, you know, just kind of gave lip service to the morality of death. He's like, that's not going to fly anymore. You need to choose. Now, when you put it that way, morality of life or morality of death, like it seems like a really obvious choice. So why? You know, and this had not occurred to me, but Ankur was saying, why spend all this time, you know, talking about, you know, why you need to choose and why you should choose life? Because, again, that doesn't seem like it should be a hard sell. And it's not because the people he's addressing are dumb, it's because, or obtuse, it's because a lot of people, you know, subconsciously hold this belief that being moral means being self-destructive. It amounts, and that's true, right? The morality of death is all about that. But, you know, if you regard morality as such as being self-destructive, then being evil promotes your joy and is practical. And being moral promotes your destruction and misery. You know what I mean? And is impractical. So, you know what I mean? And especially since it's a subconsciously held view, it's very, very hard, one, to identify that, and two, to really root it out and change one's thinking. And I think it's something that's very psychologically insightful. It's really hard to change subconsciously held ideas. I think we've all experienced that firsthand. So did that connect to what you were saying? Cause
I think so. I'm getting pretty deep here in the woods. So, I mean, my brain is starting to be like, okay, wait a second now, but no, I get what you're saying, and it's something that I need to think about. But sometimes here's the thing with Atlas and with other stuff that that I'm, you know, either that I'm reading or whatever, is sometimes doing a podcast and bringing up these issues. You shouldn't talk about it. You should think about it a little bit and not react right away. But unfortunately, when you're doing a show, you have to have some sort of something on the air. So, like, I worry sometimes, okay, I get, like, I want to soak that in and then reply before I actually say something else.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So it's like, yeah.
You on the spot, buddy. It's just, again.
Oh, no,
just,
I know.
You know. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, it's totally fine. I just, sometimes if I don't answer right away or something, you know, it's because I'm thinking or whatever, and it's hard to, I don't want to see. And I've already felt like I've done that a few times where I'm like, I said something. I'm like, wait, I should flesh that out and give it a little more breathing room to think about. And so that's one of the things that I worry about with, you know, sometimes doing a podcast is like getting deep into this stuff and me not being an intellectual or a philosopher, you know, and then all of a sudden I'm talking about some deep, you know, Ankur Gatte type seminar. And I'm like, wait a second, I think we might've gotten a little too far in the weeds and I need to think about it. So, I mean, it's still fun to do it. I don't care. like I just enjoy doing this. I mean, whatever. But I just don't want to give the people, if anyone's listening, the wrong impression. Like I have all the answers, because I don't. Not even close. So if I answer incorrectly and sound like a like it's bad coming out bad, it's because it probably is.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, one of the first questions Uncle Grate asked is, like, who is he addressing with this three-hour speech? And I was like, well, Dagny, because he wants her to leave with him. You know what I mean? I was so focused on the romance, which is far and away my favorite part. That, you know, this is me being a little obtuse, right? You know, he keeps saying you and in sort of a derogatory manner. At one point he says you moral cannibals. I mean, obviously he's not talking to Dagny when he says that.
Right.
It was just, the moment where he explicitly does, you know, say my love, you know what I mean? That was the part that stood out to me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
To say, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'm bringing this up as an example where I completely relate. You know what I mean? There's so much that I missed, and I'm so grateful that there are professional philosophers out there who can actually draw out the, you know, some of the more obvious points about which I'm being completely obtuse. And some of the subtler points about which I'm also being completely obtuse.
Yeah. Well, and I love when Greg Salmieri or Ankar or whoever will say something, and you'll be like, oh, I get it, and it's so obvious, but I didn't catch it. It just, but when they say it, it's like, okay, you know, bang, boom, you know what I mean? And but like it's not. See, that's the thing. Like, you don't just grab it like they do. I mean, look, they're professionals and all that, but it's really, and when you do, it's great. But then it's like, you have to hold it, you know, and you have to think, and you have to, you still have to, you know, make sure that you understand. But I love those little points, in Rand, when it's like, she'll say something or there'll be something that she wrote or whatever. And you're like, oh my God, it makes complete sense. You know, but you have to still be able to think about it and, you know, internalize it. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know. I could just, there's just so many things that I could discover from her that are just great, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think our conversation has been really illustrative of that, right? You know, we're talking about the state of evasion and of drift and, you know, the villains of Atlas Shrugged and connecting it to education and depression and anxiety. And, just to recapitulate the episode, right? There's so many ways you could, you know, so many things from which you could, excuse me, you could glean from Atlas Shrugged, and different ways you could integrate it with your knowledge, because it is in a way very, very abstract, which means it applies to a lot of different fields and ideas. I empathize completely with the need to sort of sit back and chew it and relate it to, you know, my own sort of narrow field.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. So it's great learning a lot, and this is a great conversation, Meg. I've really enjoyed it. It's one of our highlights, I think.
We'll see what BlogTalk has to say about it.
Yeah, right. We'll see what the numbers say. Yeah, okay. It always takes a couple of days before I can see how many people listen, whatever. So hopefully, but hey, I enjoy it. I hope you did too. I think
absolutely.
It's time to share bond. So next Wednesday, we'll just do it again. Hopefully we have, it'll just be us. If maybe Stuart, I'm sure Stuart will be back, and some others. And Yeah, it's been great. Hope the job is going well for you. Everything is going well on my end.
Just
keep on trucking. How many glasses did you get through in this episode?
Maybe one and a half.
Maybe one and a half. Okay. So
cold 30. So that's, I mean, I feel it. In case anyone's
okay.
Wondering.
We'll just call it an even 3 then. So. All right, Meg. We'll be in contact about it the next show, and we'll see you guys all next Wednesday. Wednesday at 8:00 Central Standard Time. And that's all I got, Meg. Last words.
I always feel so stupid at this point, right? Like, I don't have a good answer to that.
I know.
Live long and prosper.
Live long. It's hard to end.
Not even
so
original.
Sad. No. That's okay, though. We can go with it. We'll go with that for now. All right, Meg, we'll see you next Wednesday. We'll be in contact as well. And everybody have a great rest of your week, and we'll see you. There's going to be no music. I'm just shutting it down here, so... Have a great evening. Have a great one.
Mm-hmm. You too, buddy.
All right. Cheers. Take care. Bye.